Hi everyone, and welcome back to the 23rd video for the Old Testament Survey course. We're continuing our investigation of the historical books, and in this section, we're looking at the books of 1st and 2nd Kings. First, the background issues. Now, we're talking about both 1st and 2nd Kings together in this section. Just like 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings were originally one book, and they still are in the Hebrew Bible. We won't divide them into separate sections in order to help you to get the big picture of them both together, and also because there is no natural breaking point between the two books like there was with Samuel. Now, in the English Bible, 1st and 2nd Kings break right in the middle of one story. Now, the author of the book of Kings is anonymous. Possibly, it's the same author as Samuel, because the two books, they form a unified history of the monarchy in Israel. And the author was almost certainly a prophet about the time of the exile. Now, because this book ends at the exile, and it tells a story from the prophetic perspective, which we'll discuss later, some have suggested Jeremiah wrote these books. Now, that's possible, but probably not him, just someone like him. Around the time, a prophet around the time of the exile. Now, as I mentioned, these books continue the story of the monarchy, and they pick up where the book of Samuel left off. These books continue the question of the fate of the kingship. Saul was bad, David was mostly good, what next? Will the nation live in scrub? Will they live happily ever after? Or not. Now, you see, Kings was written primarily at the time of the exile to show that the exile was deserved, to highlight Deuteronomistic theology. The reason the nation is experiencing punishment is because it was unfaithful. Remember, the primary history was written at least partly to explain the exile and to defend God's actions as just. So some of the stories in 1st and 2nd Kings, they will be slanted to the negative. You see, Israel, even with the best of advantages, they were not able to keep the covenant. They need a savior. And that should lead us to not completely trust in ourselves or in other people, not to completely trust. But our complete trust we give to God. He is our hope. Now, the time period covered in the books of Kings is from the death of David around 970 BC until the exile around 530 BC. Now, let's look at the organization of the books of Kings. Kings is divided into three sections, based on the content of each section. The first section talks about the reign of King Solomon, David's son. And the highlight of this section is the building and dedication of the temple. Then the second section covers the divided kingdom. And in this period, the United Kingdom under David and Solomon is divided into two separate nations. The southern kingdom contains two of the 12 tribes and is named after the dominant tribe, Judah. And the northern kingdom contains the other 10 tribes and is called Israel. Now, this can be confusing because the unified nation of 12 tribes is also called Israel, and the northern kingdom of 10 tribes is called Israel. You know, try to keep these distinct in your mind. Now, sometimes these two nations are at enmity, they're at war with one another, and sometimes they peacefully coexist and are even allies in certain periods. Now, at the end of this period, the northern kingdom Israel was conquered by Assyria around 721-722 BC, and it ceased to exist as a nation. And that brings us to the third section, which is Judah alone. See, the southern kingdom continued to exist for another century and a half until it is eventually conquered by Babylon around 586-587 BC. Now let's look at the content of Kings, starting with some key verses. First is 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. It says, Solomon made an alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married his daughter. He brought her to the city of David until he finished building his palace and the temple of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. The people, however, were still sacrificing in the high places because a temple had not yet been built for the name of the Lord. Solomon showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of his father David, except that he offered sacrifices and burnt incense on the high places. Now, as we'll see in more detail later, the reign of Solomon was both good and bad. And this conflicted character is represented in this verse, where it says Solomon loved the Lord, which is true, but it also mentions the exception. Solomon's reign demonstrated the internal contradiction we see in many Christian lives, that there's genuine dedication to the Lord, but there's also compromise and conflicting loyalties. Next is 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 22 through 30. It says, Then Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in front of the whole assembly of Israel, spread out his hands towards heaven and said, O Yahweh, God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven above or on earth below. You who keep your covenant of love with your servants, who continue wholeheartedly in your way, you have kept your promise to your servant David, my father. With your mouth you have promised, and now with your hand you have fulfilled it, as it is today. Now, Yahweh, God of Israel, keep for your servant David, my father, the promises you made to him when you said, You shall never fail to have a man to sit before me on the throne of Israel, if only your sons are careful in all that they do to walk before me as you have done. And now, O God of Israel, let your word that you've promised your servant David, my father, come true. But will God really dwell on earth? The heavens, even the highest heaven, cannot contain you. How much less this temple that I have built? Yet give attention to your servant's prayer and his plea for mercy, O Lord my God. Hear the cry and the prayer that your servant is praying in your presence this day. May your eyes be open towards this temple night and day, this place of which you said, My name shall be there, so that you will hear the prayer your servant prays towards this place. Hear the supplication of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray towards this place. Hear from heaven your dwelling place, and when you hear, forgive. Now these verses are Solomon's prayer at the dedication of the temple. It's an acknowledgement that the temple cannot really contain the infinite God, but it also recognizes that God has chosen and promised to put his name and his presence in this particular place. And did you notice how it draws on the promise of the Davidic covenant? And so the temple is a location to focus prayer and the dedication of the Lord's people to him. Then 1 Kings chapter 8, verses 56 through 61 says, Praise be to Yahweh, who has given rest to his people Israel just as he promised. Not one word has failed of all the good promises he gave through his servant Moses. May the Lord our God be with us as he was with our fathers. May he never leave us nor forsake us. May he turn our hearts to him, to walk in all his ways and to keep his commands, decrees, and regulations that he gave our fathers. And may these words of mine, which I have prayed before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God day and night, that he may uphold the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel according to each day's need, so that all the people of the earth may know that Yahweh is God and that there is no other. But your hearts must be fully committed to the Lord our God, to live by his decrees and obey his commands as it is this time. Now this passage is also at the dedication of the temple, and it is Solomon's charge to the people. Now notice that he highlights none of God's promises have failed. And he prays for God's blessing on the people to help them keep his commands. And the purpose is so that all the nations of the earth will know that he is Yahweh. And finally, he charges the people to remain faithful to the covenant. And then is 1 Kings chapter 9, verses 4 through 7, in which God is speaking to Solomon, and he says, "As for you, if you walk before me in integrity of heart and uprightness, as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father when I said, you shall never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel. But if you or your sons turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I have given them and will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name. Israel will then become a byword and an object of ridicule among all peoples." Now, this passage is immediately after the dedication of the temple, and it's both a promise and a warning. It's classic Deuteronomistic theology. If Solomon and the nation are faithful, it will go well. But if they're unfaithful, the nation will be destroyed. Then 1 Kings 18:21 says, "Elijah went before the people and said, 'How long will you waver between two opinions? If Yahweh is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him.' But the people said nothing." Now, in this famous passage where Elijah sets up the contest between God and the false gods at Mount Carmel, he challenges the people to get off the fence. Either wholeheartedly follow God or choose other gods. Now, this is reminiscent of the challenge that Joshua gave to the Israelites. Choose this day the God you're going to serve. Because God does not allow divided loyalties and half-hearted service. Then 2 Kings chapter 17, 18 through 20 says, "So Yahweh was very angry with Israel, and he removed them from his presence. Only the tribe of Judah was left, and even Judah did not keep the commands of the Lord their God. They followed the practices Israel had introduced. Therefore the Lord rejected all the people of Israel. He afflicted them and gave them into the hands of plunderers, and he thrust them from his presence." Now this passage summarizes the destruction of the northern kingdom, and it gives a theological reason why it happened. The people were idolaters and had broken covenant with the Lord. And therefore, he kicked them out of his land, out of his presence. And then in 2 Kings chapter 23, verses 26 through 27. Nevertheless, the Lord did not turn away from the heat of his fierce anger, which burned against Judah because of all that Manasseh had done to provoke him to anger. So the Lord said, "I will remove Judah also from my presence as I removed Israel, and I will reject Jerusalem, the city I chose, and this temple about which I said, 'There shall my name be.'" Now this passage gives a similar summary of the destruction of the southern kingdom. And special mention is made of King Manasseh, whose rule was so evil that God has sworn to reject his people and his place, fulfilling his promise to Solomon that if you or your sons are unfaithful, I will even reject this temple where I've placed my name, and you will be a byword. And then finally, 2 Kings chapter 24, verses 1 through 4. During Jehoiakim's reign, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, invaded the land, and Jehoiakim became his vassal for 3 years. But then he changed his mind and rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar. The Lord sent Babylonian, Aramean, Moabite, and Ammonite raiders against him. He sent them to destroy Judah in accordance with the word of the Lord proclaimed by his servants, the prophets. Surely these things happened to Judah according to the Lord's command, in order to remove them from his presence because of the sins of Manasseh and all that he had done, including the shedding of innocent blood, for he had filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, and the Lord was not willing to forgive. Now this passage tells of the capture and destruction of Judah and Jerusalem for the same reasons as given in the previous verses. So that at the end of the book of Kings, both kingdoms were destroyed because of unfaithfulness to God and breaking the covenant. Now the northern kingdom completely disappears, and the southern kingdom is taken into exile into Babylon. Now let's look at in more detail each of the sections of Kings, starting with the reign of Solomon. Now the highlight of Solomon's reign was the building of the temple. Remember that David had already provided a place and made preparations for the temple. And the temple in Jerusalem served the same function as the tabernacle, that is, the presence of God among his people. In fact, the temple is basically the tabernacle, just made permanent. The floor plan is exactly like the tabernacle, except bigger. And instead of movable materials, it is made of permanent, precious stones. And the temple became a wonder, an architectural marvel that displayed God's greatness for the surrounding nations. It was impressive. And the temple is dedicated with much ceremony as the place of God's presence, the place where he has placed his name, the place to pray, to sacrifice, and to meet with him. Now, remember, Solomon is warned at the end of the temple dedication. He and Israel could go either way, good or bad. Now, what do you typically think when you hear King Solomon? Was he a good guy or a bad guy? Was he a good king or a bad king? Now, we've already mentioned the contradictory character of Solomon's reign. Now, in one sense, Solomon's reign was the height of the blessing and prosperity of the kingdom of Israel. It never got better than this. Remember this diagram? The earthly kingdom reached the height of its prosperity and power at the time of Solomon. The earthly kingdom reached the height of its territorial expansion at the time of Solomon. Now, it said that they looked down on silver because gold was so plentiful in the prosperity of Solomon's time. And Solomon is also described as the epitome of wisdom. And the people came from far countries to hear the wisdom of Solomon, which was given by God. And it is truly said, Solomon loved and worshiped the Lord. And yet, in another sense, Solomon's reign was the beginning of the downfall of the kingdom of Israel. See, by the end of his reign, Solomon had led the nation into idolatry. He set up temples for other gods to please his many foreign wives. And like Saul, Solomon started so well, but ended badly. And when we pay attention to the narrative technique that the author uses to tell Solomon's story, we learn some important truths. First, notice the way that the author describes the power and prosperity of Solomon. In chapters 10 and 11, he highlights how Solomon had amassed huge amounts of gold, how he traded in horses, and how he married multiple wives to secure alliances with surrounding nations. Now, by the way that this is told, it seems like the author is highlighting how blessed and how prosperous Solomon was. And I admit, for the longest time, that's how I read this account. But then I remembered, I made the connection between this passage when I read in Deuteronomy chapter 17, where God warns through Moses that the future king was not to amass horses, wives, or gold, nor put his trust in these things, because they would be his downfall. See, the writer of Kings highlights that Solomon did the very things that Deuteronomy said God's king should not do, so that a reader who's familiar with God's word would notice what he was saying about Solomon. And second, I want to point out a large-scale sandwich structure. And I want to give credit for this to Bruce Waltke. Now, the way that the author organizes the first 11 chapters highlights the reason for Solomon's failure. It starts with a prophet intervening to make Solomon king. And it ends with a prophet promising Jeroboam would rule over part of the divided kingdom. Next, Solomon gets rid of all his rivals to the throne. And next to last, God raises up rivals to Solomon, including Jeroboam, who we'll meet in a minute. Next, Solomon is faithful and receives wisdom. And next from last, Solomon engages in blatant idolatry. Next, Solomon uses his wisdom to judge justly. And next from last, Solomon uses Israel for forced labor, enriching and glorifying himself. Next, Solomon prepares to build the temple. And next from last, Solomon dedicates the temple. But he is warned by God of the punishment if he is unfaithful. Next, Solomon builds the temple. And next from last, Solomon furnishes the temple. And then right in the middle is the story of Solomon building rival buildings, rivals to the temple. See, Solomon builds his own palace and a palace for his foreign wife. And we're told the temple took 7 years to build, but these rival buildings took 13 years. So we're given the hint that Solomon had other loyalties that he put above God. And so, even at the foundation of Solomon's reign, it's already starting to show cracks. And before long, the house fell down. And this leads to the next section, the divided kingdom. And we need to ask the question, why was the kingdom divided? And on the one hand, it was God's purpose, promised as punishment for Solomon's idolatry. God took away 10 tribes from Solomon's son, yet left him 2 tribes because of his promise that David would always have descendants on the throne. Yet on the other hand, it was divided because of the pride and the stupidity of Rehoboam, Solomon's son. He refused to listen to the wise older advisors, and he only listened to his peers who did not yet have the wisdom of experience. And I hope the younger generation of church leaders takes warning and learns from those who have gone before. And so 10 tribes rebelled under the leadership of Jeroboam. And Jeroboam was told by God, be faithful. And God offered him a dynasty similar to the Davidic covenant if Jeroboam was faithful. But Jeroboam was profoundly unfaithful. And that for political reasons. He didn't trust in God's word. And he set up an alternate religion using golden calves. Does that sound familiar? Using them as a rival to the temple in Jerusalem. And so Jeroboam led the northern kingdom into blatant idolatry from the start of his reign, from the start of the division. Now, through the rest of these books, we see the stories of the rest of the kings of Judah and Israel told in overlapping chronological order. And each story is told in a typical pattern, a cycle, which has these typical features. First, an introduction, which often has a synchronistic statement, which places their reign in relationship to the king of the other nation. That is, so-and-so started a reign in the so-and-so year of this other king. And it also tells the king's age when he began to reign and or the length of his reign. Sometimes it tells the identity of his mother. But then is the most important part of the cycle of every king. That is the evaluation sentence. This is where God tells whether they were a good or a bad king. Whether they did good in the eyes of the Lord or did evil. And the southern kings, they're all compared to David. And the northern kings, they're all compared to Jeroboam. The next in the cycle, it tells the events of their reign. And near the end of each cycle, it gives a reference to another document. Go see so-and-so for more information about their reign. And then finally is an account of their death, burial, and their successor. Now, make sure to notice whenever the author deviates from this pattern. For instance, King Ahab's cycle is huge because the stories of Elijah and Elisha are smack right in the middle of his reign, because it was necessary for God to do this because of what King Ahab was doing. Now, in this survey, we don't have time to go through each king, but we'll just list them and notice if they were a good king or a bad king. First, the kings of the northern kingdom Israel. And I've color-coded them by dynasty. In other words, the kings whose names are in the same color are all father to son, passing down the kingship to the next generation. And notice how often the dynasties change. And they usually change by assassination. One king is killed, and his killer takes over as king. And some kings last less than a week before they're killed. See, the northern kings, they're acting just like the kings of the surrounding nations. Cutthroat politics to get and keep power. And also notice that all of the kings of the northern kingdom are evaluated as bad kings, because they all follow the idolatry of Jeroboam. And the ones who aren't like Jeroboam are worse, worshiping the gods of the Canaanites. And now let's look at the kings of the southern kingdom, Judah. Now, all these kings, except one, are direct descendants of David. Notice that 8 were good kings and 11 were bad. And I want to point out 2 who were especially bad. One is the wicked queen Athaliah. She was not descended from David. She tried to take over the kingdom and was successful for a time. And she almost wiped out the descendants of David. But of course, she was not successful. And soon she received her just punishment. And the second especially bad king I want to mention is Manasseh. And the book of Kings states that he was so bad in his wickedness, idolatry, and cruelty that God determined to judge and destroy the southern kingdom. Now I want to take a bit of a digression to look at a few items of international politics that have a direct bearing on this story. The first is the Aram-Ephraim alliance. That is, the northern kingdom Israel teams up with the nation of Aram to fight Judah. And this illustrates how far they have fallen. They are partnering with pagans and fighting against God's people. The second is the Assyrian Empire. This empire had its capital first at Ashur and later at the city of Nineveh. Some of its most famous kings are Sargon and Tiglath-Pileser. And this empire reached its height in the 7th century BC. And this empire conquered the northern kingdom in 722-721 BC. And then the third is the Babylonian Empire. It had its capital in Babylon. It rebelled against and then conquered eventually the Assyrian Empire. And it had famous kings like Nabopolassar and Nebuchadnezzar. And it reached its height in the 6th century BC. And the Babylonian Empire conquered the southern kingdom Judah in 587-586 BC. Now, speaking of conquest, let's look at the punishment and destruction of the two kingdoms. Remember that the book of Kings was written to describe the reason for the exile. So the reasons are all over this book in the record of the many idolatries of Israel and Judah. And it directly explains the reasons for the captivity by referencing the verses in the Torah where God threatens to kick them out of the land that he'd given them if they break the covenant. And it often compares the requirements of the covenant with the actual behavior of the people. Now, let me give you just one example among many that I could give. In 2 Kings chapter 17, it gives a theological reason why the northern kingdom was conquered. 17:7 says, "All this took place because the Israelites had sinned against Yahweh their God, who had brought them up out of Egypt from under the power of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. They worshiped other gods." Now, I want you to notice this is almost a direct quote of the first commandment from Exodus chapter 20, verses 2 and 3, which says, "I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me." And then the rest of this chapter continues in a similar manner. It kind of goes down the summary list of how God commanded Israel to live, and then it shows how Israel had broken every one. And not only that, but God had sent prophets to call them back to faithfulness, and they had ignored or persecuted God's prophets. And that brings us to the last item I want to highlight from the content of the book of Kings, and that is the prophets. There are a number of prophets whose ministry is described in these books. And I want to highlight just two, Elijah and Elisha, whose ministry sets the standard for the other prophets. Now, please don't confuse these two because their names are so similar. I'll try to enunciate to distinguish them. First is Elijah. Elijah stood against the idolatry of Ahab and his wicked wife Jezebel. He arranged the contest at Mount Carmel, where God proved himself to be the true God. And the point of this whole episode is that Yahweh is God. No idolatry in Israel because there is no other God. And Elijah's story is also told with narrative art. Let me share another pattern from Dr. Waltke. This happens when Elijah had fled to the mountain of God from the revenge of Jezebel, as told in 1 Kings chapter 19. It says, "The word of the Lord came to him. And the word of the Lord asked, 'What are you doing here?' And Elijah responded, 'I have been zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death. I am the only one left, and they're trying to kill me also.' The Lord said, 'Go stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, who will pass by.'" Now, do you spot the reference to an earlier story? That God passed by Moses on that very same mountain and proclaimed his name. The Lord, gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger, full of chesed and emet, maintaining love to thousands, forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. But he does not leave the guilty unpunished, but punishes the children and their children for the sin of the fathers to the third and fourth generations." That story. Now, in Elijah's story, we're told that there was a powerful wind. But we're told God was not in the wind. Then there was a mighty earthquake. But God was not in the earthquake. Then there was a great fire, but God was not in the fire. And then there was a voice of a small whisper. Now, what's going on here? What are we supposed to make of this story? Well, let's continue reading and see what the author does. The next thing we're told is that Elijah went out of the cave and a voice spoke to him. And the word of the Lord asked, "What are you doing here?" And Elijah responded, "I have been zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death. I am the only one left, and they're trying to kill me too." Now, I hope you see the pattern developing. Let's see where it goes. The Lord said, "Go back the way you came. Go to the desert of Damascus. Anoint Hazael king over Aram. Then anoint Jehu king over Israel. And then anoint Elisha as your successor." Now, notice that Elijah is influencing the destiny of nations. And these two kings will put to death the unfaithful in Israel. And Elijah is also influencing the religious leadership of the next generation, kind of like choosing the next pope or whatever. But notice the parallel. Even though these things were big and impressive and they impacted history, that's not where God is. And that's especially appropriate in our own day, where people are making such a big deal about politics. Now, politics is important and influential, and they do influence things. But we might be tempted to think that this is the most important thing. And again, I don't want to say that politics and leadership are unimportant, especially in this country where the people are responsible for the government of the people. Christians must do their part to be salt and light in every part of culture, including politics. But this passage clearly implies that that is not the most important. Even if you are given the opportunity to make kings, that's not where God is. See, the next thing in the story is quiet like a whisper, but that's where God's presence is. God tells Elijah, "I have reserved 7,000 in Israel who have not bowed the knee to Baal." That is, the faithful remnant is where the hope is, both in Elijah's time and in ours. Never underestimate the influence of many normal people being completely faithful, sold out to God in everyday life. Now, finally, Elijah does not die. He's taken into heaven in a whirlwind, and the prophetic calling passes to Elisha. And Elisha does many miracles that foreshadow the ministry of Jesus. And Elisha impacts the surrounding nations. And then all the later writing prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah, all the rest, also ministered in the time of kings. But we're going to discuss them later when we look at the prophetic books. So now let's look at the theological themes of the book of Kings. The first is Deuteronomistic theology. And I hope you've already noticed this theme from what we've already discussed. And I also hope that you don't need an explanation of this theme at this point. But I just want to point out that the author uses this idea to tell the story of the kings and to explain the reason for the exile. Then the second theme is the prophetic perspective. That is, the mindset of the prophets, but also the way the author of Kings tells the story. It is a different way of looking at the world, looking at the events of these days. It means evaluating by God's standards, not by human standards. It's judging value, it's judging success by God's values, from God's perspective, not from the worldly perspective of our society. And in this book, it's primarily concerned with covenant faithfulness and loyalty to God. And this is displayed by faithfulness to temple and faithfulness to Israelite religion and to Torah. And this means no idolatry. And David and Jeroboam are used as measuring standards for the good and bad, respectively. Now, how does this work out in our lives? What's the most important standard of success in your life? Is it money? Is it fashion? Good looks? Good grades? Popularity? Now, if you listen to the media all around us, the most important things, be good looking, be rich, be famous, be powerful, and everything will be great. You'll be happy. But that's not where God is. Now, there's nothing wrong with having money or being good looking, etc. But according to God, the most important things are character and faithfulness to God and God's ways. Beauty will fade when you get older. Money will burn up and go away. But character and faithfulness last eternally. Nothing is more important than this. And this is how our lives will ultimately be evaluated. Please keep this in mind when you make all of your decisions. Try to make your priorities conform to God's priorities. So now let's review. First, we'll review the three sections of kings. They are Solomon, divided kingdom, and Judah alone. And let's review the two items of international politics. They are Assyria conquers Israel around 721 BC, and Babylon conquers Judah around 586 BC. So remember the nation that conquered, the nation that was conquered, and the date. Now, these are the only two dates that I will test you on in this course. But I want you to know all this information for reference. Now, finally, let's review the theological themes. And they are Deuteronomistic theology and prophetic perspective. Now, please make sure that you understand each of these items and have an idea how they are worked out in the books of Kings. Now, as usual, there's a ton of stuff from these books of Kings that we've left out. But I hope you get the big picture of the content of 1 and 2 Kings. Now, in the next section, we'll continue with the books of 1 and 2 Chronicles. Thanks for watching.